This podcast is brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Keep Joy on air by becoming a member, a subscriber, or donate. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.
The National LGBTI Health Alliance held its 8th conference, Health in Difference 2013, Our Bodies, Our Minds, in Melbourne in April 2013. Joy 94.9, Australia's only radio station for our diverse communities, is proud to partner with the Alliance to bring you this recording of the 2013 conference.
Catherine Barrett, Dr. Catherine Barrett, a researcher, educator and advocate's perspective. And as the chair of the steering committee of the National LGBTI Ageing and Aged Care Strategy, a successful advocate at that. Beginning her career as a nurse working in residential aged care, it was in this context that Catherine's interest in sexual health and ageing grew. Catherine developed strategies to resource staff and respond affirmatively to sexual expression and noticed how this improved the quality of person-centred care provided. Since moving into the university sector, Catherine has continued working in the area of sexual health. Catherine currently coordinates a number of research and education projects around sexual health and ageing and has a particular interest in the development of resources and the provisions of education that takes a systemic approach to improvement. Please welcome Dr. Catherine Barrett.
Thanks, everyone. And I've got to say, as one of the coordinators of Val's Cafe, Kathy Noble's our patron, so lovely to follow on from you. And I think it wouldn't be right to have a conference that had streams on LGBTI ageing without older people here. And I hope that at the next conference we have many more older LGBTI folk presenting. Good. Noel Tovey was going to speak this morning too, but he's had surgery a couple of weeks ago and he's in rehabilitation and has asked me to let you know that he's doing very well. He's a very tough man. But he and I have met and had a number of phone calls and he's given input into this presentation, and he's also, there's some slides with his voice more directly as well too. But the task that I think one of us set, might have been me, might have been you, somebody set, was around, you know, have we moved from a period of discrimination to one of education, and, you know, what are the possibilities in the future for celebrating older LGBTI people? So that's what I would like to do. And just recognising from the outset, Noel Tovey. And the first part of the presentation is really looking at discrimination. And, excuse me, we're very fortunate at Val's Cafe and Gay and Lesbian Health Victoria to have received a grant from Beyond Blue to look at the experiences of old LGBTI people in terms of their discrimination and the effect of that on their depression and anxiety. It was a very small study, 12 old LGBTI people, and working with our colleague Jude Comfort, who's here somewhere from WA. I think in terms of discrimination and understanding historical experiences, what I would like to do is let the older people speak for themselves. I knew that Kathy was speaking, so and would present a trans perspective. So there's a perspective here from an older lesbian and from an older gay man. And there are four parts to each story, and I would like to let the older people speak for themselves in terms of discrimination. So just to start with, from Dawn. I was married in 1964 as part of the expectation of my family, I suppose you could say. Back then, I didn't know what a lesbian was. I was a country kid, sheltered, and had a normal sort of an upbringing. So it really came as a surprise to me that I had these attractions. I was so busy being the perfect mother, the perfect wife, the perfect everything, that I put my needs on the shelf. I said I was leaving with Anne, and the response I got was, "You're insane." My parents actually got me into the car and said, "We've got an appointment with Pell, Cardinal Pell." They said, "You're a sick person, we're taking you to Pell." I don't know what he was expected to do, cure her, I suspect. Our husbands had prominent positions in a small country town. I think if we hadn't have left, they would have run us out of town anyway. When we left town, we just threw a few things into the car and drove. We didn't know where we were going, we just drove. And I think they had about $100 between them. There was a lot of interference and pressure on my former husband not to allow the children to see me. It would be, what's the word? they would be corrupt, I think. They would become corrupt, corrupted by our relationship. That was their biggest fear, that I would corrupt the children, that they would be deviants or something. I was encouraged by my parents to butt out, leave them alone. A well-meaning good friend said, well, it's no use you fighting this to get the children because you'll just drain all your money and you won't win. I had no rights. I might have had rights, but I wasn't able to exercise them. I saw my children once a year for a couple of years. I was reconciled with my son after 30 years. I nearly went insane because I'd been brought up to be this conservative, dutiful person, and to be confronted with these sort of decisions was just, it was too much. Outwardly, I was very unstable because I was trying to deal with all these things. You just think of the list of stresses in your life. I had a loss of identity for a start, a loss of children, a loss of home, a loss of income, a loss of parents and family, a loss of friends. When you add all those things up, it's a major stress for someone who lived a very sheltered life. That affected my mental health. I was really very, very ill mentally. I was so distraught, I can remember taking my old little car out into the bush with a few sleeping tablets and tried to kill myself. Unfortunately, she wasn't successful. I had values that I stuck to. I just don't think you throw your values out willy-nilly like the garbage. When I was trying to work out whether or not I should go with Anne or stay with my husband, I found an autograph book that as a kid was all the fashion. And in it, my father wrote, above all else, above all things, to thine own self be true. It was when I reread it, I knew that's it. That's what I've got to do. Thanks, Dad. I think it's a really amazing story because this is a woman who's had the most extraordinary experiences of discrimination and, you know, has somehow, you know, found a way to survive and have a happy life. I find her story really very compelling. And there's one more story that I want to share with you, and it's Larry's story. And Larry's story is called Life is Beautiful, which is, you know, perhaps one of the most remarkable things about it. When I was 14, my mother knew that there was something different. She spoke to my father and they went to a doctor and they put me in a psychiatric institution. I was in that institution for nearly 4 months having shock treatment to try and cure me of the way I was feeling because I was depressed and I was more or less interested in playing with dolls and that type of thing. So the shock treatment was supposed to have worked, and when I got out of the psychiatric institution, my father and I still didn't see eye to eye, so I joined the Navy. I was in the Navy for 12 years, and I still realised I was different. I confessed to the chaplain that I was gay, and I got discharged from the Army. When I came home, I met a chap there, and he told me, "There's nothing wrong with you." And then I thought, yeah, okay, fine. Thank God for love. I've been arrested, I've been taken to jail, I've been questioned, but I couldn't do a damn thing about it. I went to a toilet once for a legitimate reason, and there was a man in there playing with himself. So I started to walk out and he says, "Hey, what do you think of this?" And I said, "Well, I think you better put that away, hadn't you?" Next thing, someone came in behind me and said, "You're under arrest." That was a setup, and that used to go on time and time again. A lot of gays used to meet in toilets because there was no other place for them to meet. When I was 24, I met John, my partner of 44 years. We were soulmates. My mother treated him as him. My father hated him. My mother had a stroke and my father wrote me a letter asking if I could come home to nurse her. I spoke with John and John said, "Well, she's your mother, so let's go." My father promised that he would buy a lovely farm for John and I if we did that. So I got my mother fit and was walking again, and my father says, "Right, John's got to get off the property." We had an argument and he threw an axe at John. So John and I packed up and left, and we came back to the city. We ended up with nothing. Anyway, when my mother died, John and I went to the funeral. Dad told John that he couldn't come into the church. I tried to commit suicide because I had these feelings and I thought, that's like my father says, that's not on, that's dirty. When people didn't treat me well, I managed with difficulty because it wasn't right for a man to cry as far as my father was concerned. But I used to go away and cry, and many times I've cried. You would cry. You would cry yourself to sleep some nights because of some of the things that were said to you. And I think, oh, I wonder if they're right. Or you didn't know if you were sick or not. All this used to burn its little tentacles into your brain, and it stays there. Believe me, it stays there. To me, it's a great world if you don't weaken, and if you're honest with yourself. Since I've become honest with myself, life is beautiful. It's a learning journey, all right. Let's face it, everybody's learning. No matter what, you're learning something right from the word go. By learning to accept yourself, life, it's beautiful. I tell you what, colours are more vibrant. You walk around the park and everything is more beautiful, and you notice things that you've never noticed before. Since I've been honest with myself, my eyes dance a lot more. What an amazing story that he had those extraordinary experiences of discrimination that both Larry and Dawn did, had the most extraordinary experiences of discrimination, and they've found ways of coming through it and they have survived. And, you know, Larry wants to call his story Life is Beautiful. And, you know, he's found something really beautiful and meaningful in all of that. And I find their stories really quite remarkable, and I think it wouldn't be appropriate of me to comment on historical experiences of discrimination when this is a group of people who, you know, if we give them the chance, can speak so aptly for themselves. But I suppose the other thing that I want to do before I move on is just acknowledge Beyond Blue again. Beyond Blue have been very patient with this report. It has taken longer than we thought. And you can imagine some of the reasons why that is the case. We're speaking to people who perhaps the last time they told somebody about discrimination and anxiety and depression, they were incarcerated and given shock treatment, or the last time someone knew they were gay, they were put in a prison. So we've had to manage this project, and I'm looking for my colleague Jude Comfort, in there she is, in such a respectful way that honours. And, you know, there's such a fine line, I think, sometimes between thematic analysis and pathologising, or, you know, your own take on somebody else's story. So we've had to be so respectful, and we are very grateful to Beyond Blue for funding this project. And there's another one coming. So, you know, by the end of next year, we will have two projects around the mental health of older LGBTI people, which is fantastic. So that's where I think we are, or that's what older people are telling us in terms of discrimination. And then the next part of the presentation was about education. And I think this is a document that makes a bridge between discrimination and education. You all got a copy of this in your show bags, and it's the National Strategy for LGBTI Ageing and Aged Care. And really, I think this is a bridge builder. I think in another 5 years, aged care services and LGBTI ageing will be different because of this. And I think there will be an end to... We are really working towards an end of institutionalised discrimination, but we're not there yet. And here are some of the things that we still haven't addressed. And one of them is the religious exemptions. Now, I really don't understand why any religious organisation would want to reserve the right to discriminate against anybody, let alone people who have had these extraordinary experiences of discrimination. And I want to acknowledge and say that, you know, Michelle Chandler's here from Uniting Care, and Steve's going to be what's that? Kelly Shields. And I did mean you, Kelly. And Kelly Shields is here. And what I wanted to say is that I think that every faith-based aged care service should have a Kelly Shields and not be reserving the right to discriminate. And, you know, your organisation does fabulous work. And, you know, I think that we really need to, as a community, to challenge that. We still have criminal records. Noel Tovey was incarcerated at the age of 17 for being gay, and he still has a criminal record. Gina talked this morning about the DSM. That's another form I put to you of institutionalised discrimination. And I think from my perspective as a person with a background in aged care services, I think institutionalised discrimination in aged care services won't be resolved until we have explicit reference to LGBTI people in the standards for residential aged care and community care. And, you know, I think that's one we can't let go of. So in terms of education, what we've done at Gay and Lesbian Health Victoria is we've developed national standards for LGBTI inclusive practice. And those standards, for those of you at lunchtime who went to the launch of the Rainbow Tick, they're being used for the Rainbow Tick, and they're also being used for aged care services. The reason why in this slide I've pulled out professional development is because in terms of education, a lot of people understand that there is a need for education. But what we've found in our work is that education, the kind of PowerPoint type of education, is not enough to change practice. That this is an area of practice that requires staff addressing their own values and beliefs. And for change to occur, you really need an organisational approach to change. So the national standards, there are six of them, and we think this systemic approach to change is the way to go. In fact, we've shown that it is. Quite successful. So we've developed the Rainbow Tick based on these standards. We've also developed an audit tool that aged care services can pick up and utilise, and we're going to make copies of those available to you outside. We've developed a process called, or a 12-month program called, How to Create a GLBTI Inclusive Service. And this is the report on the first how-to. The report on the second how-to is going to be made available to you outside. In the first program 4 years ago, there was one aged care service. And in the most recent one, 50% of the participating organisations were aged care services. So we're making a difference. And then what we've done with the standards as well is we've developed documents looking at the application of those standards to specific aged care settings. So this one's our CACPAC, which is for community aged care services. There's a HACPAC for home care. There's a TRACPAC, which is around the care of older trans people. And there's a RUCPAC, which is which is the rural one. And there's a RACPAC, which is a residential care one. And we need to do a DACPAC, which is a dementia-related one, and a FACPAC for families. And sometimes with service providers, I mean, particularly residential aged care is well regulated and there are lots of standards. And so sometimes service providers say to us, well, why do we need another set of standards, you know? And I want to show you why, because it's really important information in terms of education. Some of you might know the Dr. Riddle scale, and she looks at, you know, a continuum of homophobia in the community. And as you know, after delivering hundreds of education sessions to thousands of people, this is my own take on what I call the line. And at the bottom, you know, probably the most overt discrimination is people who run around and saying, oh, I hate gay people, you know, I hate trans people, I hate lesbians, and that overt hatred. Rarely ever see in aged care services. And I think there are people that do, but I think they're too clever to be that overt. What we see much more often is a kind of a tolerance, like, I've got nothing against the gays, but just don't shove it in my face. You know, I've got nothing against the gays, but I don't see why you need to tell me. I don't need to know who you have sex with. So there's much more of a sense of a tolerance that we say is still another form of discrimination. But what we see much more often is an attitude that we call heterosexism. And that is, we do that already, we treat everyone the same. And so there's that kind of belief that, you know, we treat everyone the same and we're not discriminating against you, so we're an inclusive service. And this is such a prevalent attitude that we named one of our latest how-to report after it. So what we are saying and what we are suggesting to service providers, that all of these, in fact, are forms of discrimination. That older LGBTI people, the absence of overt discrimination, you're not beating up clients, we're saying, well, that's still, the absence of that is still not an inclusive service. So that's where we draw the line, and we say it's really important that service providers understand where the line is. And what we're saying is that all of these factors underneath the line are staff individual responses to LGBTI clients. And staff are responding from an individual perspective, generally speaking, because there's no organisational guidance. And so there's absolutely nothing that says to people, you know, this is what the organisation expects of you. So we're saying it's time to change. We need organisational systems. We need examples like the City of Stonington and Darabin and others that have implement the standards and make it really clear to staff what the organisation's commitment to LGBTI clients is. And we've done that with the the rainbow tick, the audit tool, the how-to reports and all the ACPACs that we talked about before. So the reason for doing this, just to reiterate, is that some people think that, you know, if they're not beating up on JLBTI clients, they're an inclusive service, or they think that, you know, we'll just treat everybody the same. Isn't it just the same as being Greek or Italian? And we say, no, you know, you need to look at the history. This is really very different. And the standards go a long way to, I think, providing a framework for education. But in terms of the last one, celebration, I want to go back one step and I want to just say to you, just in context, I said to Noel, what do you think we should say for celebration? And I said to him, that, you know, from my perspective, I think that one of the things that I would like to see is I would like to see everybody value their own ageing. And I think when we value our own ageing, then we can look at the ageing in other people and value that as well. That's one of the things that I would like to see. I would like to see national studies on the health and well-being of older LGBTI people that document their narratives in a way that creates visibility, that creates education, that creates safe places where older LGBTI people feel that it's safe to come out and disclose who they are. And so I put all that to Noel and I said, what do you think we should say for celebration? And this was his delightful take on it. We are alive. We should celebrate that many of us have survived. There was no safe place to come out. You were locked away for your lifestyle. The fact that someone like me has managed to overcome being locked in jail, being vilified by the press, being hounded by friends and workfellows, I survived. We should celebrate. And I think Noel's right, you know. These historical stories of discrimination are really appalling, and it is a celebration that older LGBTI people have managed to survive it somehow, really. And I think this is my second last slide, which is some of you might have heard us talk earlier about Val Eastwood. She's another reason why we should celebrate. Val Eastwood was a lesbian who in the 1950s, when you could be rounded up and put in jail, you could be put in a psychiatric institution and given shock therapy, Val Eastwood set up a coffee lounge for JLBTI, well, for camp people at the time, for camp and theatre types. And her bohemian cafe served salmon soup and toasted pineapple sandwiches. And people came from everywhere and walked into the cafe and just said, oh my God, I'm not the only one. So, you know, people were living in a context of feeling they were the only JLBTI person in the world and went into Val's cafe and she created this place of hospitality where people could feel that they could be themselves. And what we wanted to do, we found out a couple of years ago that Val was receiving aged care services and we hoped they were the best services that they could possibly be. But we thought it struck us that it was really important that aged care services provided inclusive services for people of Val's generation, Gen V, never mind your X's and Y's, it's the V's we're worrying about. And so we set up Val's Cafe in her honour, trying to replicate that hospitality, to create aged care services that replicate that hospitality for Val. And my colleague Carolyn White has set up, is now coordinating Val's Cafe. We've got a website, we've got 180 aged care services that are members of Val's Cafe. We provide resources around LGBTI inclusive practice, advocacy, we do research. Kathy Noble is one of our patrons, as is Noel Tovey, and we're looking for an older lesbian patron, if you know of anybody. But to finish with, the final word goes to Noel Tovey. In terms of celebration, Noel says, young people can now come out. People like Val made it possible for them to come out. It was really important because there was no other place for gay people to go to and sit and talk to each other. Val created a milieu. Noel gave me a number of lessons on trying to say that in a French way, but Val created a milieu, a gathering place. You could have a gay conversation without worrying about being overheard. Gay people could go there and be themselves. It was the start of something. If you were gay, people would say, he's the kind of person that would go to Val's. Young people should be celebrating the fact that they are free. We have created a better world for young people. Now we need them to make the world a better world for us. They need to make sure that elders are treated properly. Thank you.
know, there are so many people in our community who do things on a shoestring budget. And even though it's a funded organisation, I believe that GLHV is one of the best organisations that do things on a shoestring budget. To have developed the Rainbow Tick, to have developed the inclusive service packages, to have developed... How many ACTS packs are there now? 12 almost?
I think we've got 5 and there are 2 in the waiting.
7. All with very little to no funding to develop it, and it has created a framework for change within our community that has fundamentally helped shape ageing and aged care. So can we all give a round of applause to everybody who's been at GLHV? Okay, Jude.
Thanks, Corey. First, thank you to the panel, and it's great that we see ageing has been given so much profile in this conference. A statement which I'd like some comment from the panel if possible. We've put a lot of effort into getting aged care providers to lift their game in terms of what is going to be a minimum requirement and getting them on board, getting them above the line, and I really like that diagram, Catherine. My statement is that the majority of us will spend very little time in an aged care institution. I think it's a bit of a myth that everybody thinks you turn a certain age and you get shunted off to an aged care facility. Most of us will age in the community. My challenge is I actually think the LGBTI community is incredibly ageist. What do we do as a community to challenge that and to see more visibility of older people within our own community and our own community events? I think we've put a lot of effort into getting the other side, if you like, to lift their game. What are we doing and what could we do to raise the bar on that? Thank you.
Well, as a 30-year-old, I'm going to say working on ageing and aged care is hoping to bridge the divide. But then I'm going to go down to Cathy.
Yeah, having faced this is a very big question, I think, for many of us, especially trans women and trans men, but trans women definitely. I don't think a lot of people understand that we still have to do things like taking hormones for the rest of our life. So there should be training for that. Also, the point is that a lot of trans women feel that they have to continue dilating for the rest of their life. So this is something that people have to come to understand and learn about. I find a lot of people, when they come in contact with trans people, first of all, in any phase of the walk through the world, is that, oh, you know, what are you? I've been asked the question, when did you stop being a man? And I said, I never have been. I'm a woman who suffered from a long bout of transsexualism. And basically, I think that, you know, if you can get that across to people and their understanding of it, it will make a big difference. But especially when you go into any care facility whatsoever. There is a big push at the moment to keep the elderly in the home. And to this end, there are a lot of benefits that can be done. But unfortunately, eventually you have to move out, as I'm finding with the elderly where I live.
Thank you.
I agree with what Steve said 150%. It is a fantastic thing that is happening at the moment, and we just hope that it will continue. So I hope that we can allay your fears and you will sleep tight.
Catherine?
I've got a 4-point plan, Jude. The first one is this. The profiling of ageing here, I think, is a step, a really important step. The second one is narratives from older LGBTI people, because I think the GLBTI community wants to hear and learn from older LGBTI people. And two of the other things that we're looking at doing in Victoria is the community visitor scheme, where we will look at if we are successful. It's Leanne from Switchboard. Sorry, Leanne.
It's the royal we, it's okay.
What we talked about doing in that round table was most probably having younger folk from the LGBTI community, and it will be an intergenerational project, so we'll have younger, middle-aged, mature people visiting older, socially isolated LGBTI people at home,
And the fourth point that I've got is that one of the things that we want to do with Val's Cafe is have more events in the GLBTI community. So we have a regular event at Melbourne Queer Film Festival, which is so much fun. And the other thing is too, with Midsummer, you know, I think that's the next turf for us, is to start having events so that the LGBTI community get to see and think about LGBTI ageing all the time, and it's that it's a wonderful thing.
Steve, do you have anything you want to add?
I really think that question was probably directed at everybody else but me.
Okay. I'd add two small things. One is I would like to see our gay and lesbian radios, TVs and press have more LGBTI seniors. And part of the challenge for seeing that visual representation is there's not a lot of stock images out there. And we actually, as a community, need to go and develop them so that we can show visible images. And I was very pleased. Annika from Matrix was telling me she's got a whole bunch of them if you need some lesbian older women, because, what is it? Is it 2-1 over 70 and 4-1 over 90 are women? And yet when we look at where we do see LGBTI people represented, it's men. So it's not just about the age, it's also about who's actually going to be within that age of our community of what we're trying to represent. Okay, I have a short announcement, two things. One, if you haven't read it, please read the April National LGBTI Health Alliance newsletter, Health Update. It's all about ageing and aged care, and there's a wonderfully moving speech from Noel Tovey who couldn't attend today. This is my last function as the convener of the Ageing and Aged Care Working Group, and I just want to do a very big public thank you to Warren Talbot, Warren Summers, Garvey Anasari and Sue J. Kentland in the National LGBTI Health Alliance's office for their wonderful secretariat support for me while I've been in convener. You guys rock, and can't wait to keep working with you in a new way. Thanks very much, everybody.
You have been listening to a recording from the Health in Difference 2013 conference held in Melbourne in April 2013. For more information about the National LGBTI Health Alliance, head to lgbtihealth.org.au. And for more information on Joy 94.9, Australia's only radio station for our diverse communities, explore joy.org.au.
Thanks for listening to another Joy podcast, brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Help us keep Joy on air. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.